She reached out with shaking hands and took the frail reed arrow, lifting it gingerly, and then her face cleared. "Your collar, Ben. It's lodged in the collar of your jacket. It hasn't touched you." Relief washed through me as I ran my hands up the shaft of the arrow and found that I wasn't dead. Carefully lying on my side, while Sally held the tip of the arrow from my flesh, I shrugged off my light khaki jacket. For a moment I stared in revulsion at the hand-forged iron arrowhead with the sticky, toffee-coloured material clogging the wicked barbs, and then I threw jacket and arrow aside. "God, that was close," I whispered. "Listen, Sal, I think there's only one of them here. He's a young man, panicky, probably as afraid as we are. I will try to talk to him again." I wriggled forward against the reassuring solidity of the dead tree and raised my voice in the most persuasive tones that would pass my parched throat. "I am your friend. Though you fly your arrows at me, I will not war with you. I have lived with your people. I am one with you. How else do I speak your language?" A deathly, impenetrable silence. "How else do I speak the tongue of the people?" I asked again, and strained my ears for a sound. Then the bushman spoke, his voice a high-pitched fluting, broken up with soft clucking and clicking sounds. "The devils of the forest speak in many tongues. I close my ears to your deceits. I am no devil. I have lived as one of yours. Did you never hear of the one named the Sunbird?" I used my bushman name. "Who stayed with the people of Hai and became their brother?" Another long silence followed, but now I sensed that the little bushman was undecided, puzzled, no longer afraid and deadly. "Do you know of the old man named Kai?"
"I know of him," admitted the bushman, and I breathed a little easier.
"Did you hear of the one they called the Sunbird?" Another long pause.
"I have heard men speak of it.
I am that one." Now the silence went on for 10 minutes or more. I knew the bushman was considering my claim from every possible angle. At last he spoke again.
"Kai and I hunt together this season. Even now he comes before darkness, he will be here. We will wait for him."
"We will wait for him," I agreed.
"But if you move, I will kill you," warned the bushman.
And I took him at his word. Hai, the old bushman, came to my shoulder, and heaven knows I'm no giant. He had the characteristically flattened features with high cheekbones and oriental eyes, but his skin was dry and wrinkled, like an old yellow raisin. The wrinkling extended over his entire body as though he were covered with brittle parchment. The little peppercorns of hair on his scalp were smoky grey with age, but his teeth were startling white and perfect, and his eyes were black and sparkling. I'd often thought that they were pixie eyes, alive with mischief and intelligent curiosity. When I told him how his friend had tried to kill us, he thought it an excellent joke and went off into little grunting explosions of laughter, at the same time shyly covering his mouth with one hand. The younger bushman's name was Gal, and he was married to one of Hai's daughters, so Hai felt free to josh him mercilessly.
"Sunbird is a white ghost," he wheezed. "Shoot him, Gal, quickly, before he flies away."
Overwhelmed by his own humour, Hai staggered in mirth-racked circles, giving an imitation of how he thought a ghost would look as it flew away. Gal was very embarrassed. He looked down at his feet as he shuffled them in the dust. I chuckled weakly, the sound of flighted arrows very fresh in my memory. Hai stopped laughing abruptly and demanded anxiously,
"Sunbird, have you got tobacco?" Oh, my God, I said in English. What is it? Sally was alarmed by my tone, expecting that something else horrifying had happened. Tobacco, I said. We haven't any. Neither Sally nor I used the stuff, but it is very, very precious to a bushman. Lurin left a box of cigars in the Land Rover, Sally reminded me. Is that any use? Both Gal and Chai were intrigued with the aluminium cylinders in which the Romeo and Juliet cigars were packed. After I showed them how to open them and remove the tobacco, they cooed and chattered with delight. Then Chai sniffed the cigar like the true connoisseur he was, nodded approvingly, and took a big bite. He chewed a while, and then tucked the wad of sodden cigar under his top lip. He passed the stub to Gal, who bit into it and followed Chai's example. The two of them squatted on their haunches, positively glowing with contentment, and my heart went out to them. It took so little to make them happy. They stayed with us that night, cooking on our fire a meal of bush rats threaded on a stick like kebabs, and grilled over the open coals, without gutting or removal of the skin. The hair frizzled off in the fire, and stank like burning rags. "I think I'm going to throw up," murmured Sally palely, as she watched the relish with which our two friends ate. But she didn't. "Why do they call you Sunbird?" she asked later, and I repeated her question to Chai. He jumped up and did his celebrated imitation of a sunbird, darting his head and fluttering his hands. It was convincingly done, for bushmen are wonderful observers of nature. "They say that's how I act when I get excited," I explained. "Yes, yes," Sally exclaimed, clapping her hands with delight as she recognized me, and then they were all laughing. In the morning we went to the cave together, all four of us, and in that setting the little men were completely at home. I photographed them and Sally sketched them as they sat on the rocks by the pool. She was fascinated by their delicate little hands and feet, and their enlarged buttocks, a recognized anatomical peculiarity named stetopegia, which enabled them to store food, like a camel stores water, against the contingencies of the wilderness. Gal remarked to Chai on the activity in which Sally and I had been engaged beside the pool when he discovered us the previous day, and this led to much earthy comment and laughter. Sally wanted to know the source of it, and when I told her she blushed like a sunset, which was a pleasant change, for I am usually the blusher. The bushmen were enthusiastic over Sally's sketches, and this enabled me to lead them naturally to the rock paintings. "They are the paintings of our people," Chai boasted. "This has been our place from the beginning." I pointed out the portrait of the White King, and Chai explained frankly, without any of the reserve or secrecy as I'd expected. "He is the King of the White Ghosts." "Where did he live?" "He lives with his army of ghosts on the moon," Chai explained. And my critics accuse me of being a romantic. We discussed this at some length, and I learned how the ghosts fly between moon and earth, how they are well disposed towards the bushmen, but care should be taken, as the common forest devils will sometimes masquerade as white ghosts. Gal had mistaken me for one of these. "Have the white ghosts ever been men?" I asked. "No, certainly not." Chai was a little put out by the question. "They were always ghosts, and they've always lived on the moon and these hills." "Have you ever seen them, Chai?" "My grandfather saw the Ghost King." Chai avoided the question with dignity. "And this, Chai," and I pointed to the drawings of the stone wall with its chevrons and towers. "What's this?" "Oh, that is the Moon City," Chai answered readily. "Where is it?" "On the moon?" "No, it is here." "Here?" I demanded, my blood starting to race. "You mean on these hills?" "Yes," High nodded, and took another bite of his $5 cigar. "But where, High, where? Can you show it to me?" "No," and High shook his head regretfully. "Why not, High? I'm your brother. I'm of your clan." I pleaded, "Your secrets are my secrets." "You are my brother," High agreed, "but I cannot show you the city of the moon. It is a ghost city. Only when the moon is full and the white ghosts come down, then the city stands upon the plain below the hills. But in the morning it is gone." My blood no longer raced, and my excitement cooled. "Have you seen the moon city, High?" "My grandfather saw it once, long ago."
"Grandpa was a big mover," I remarked bitterly in English.
"What is it?" Sally wanted to know.
"Oh, I'll explain later, Sal," and I turned back to the old bushman.
"Hi, in all your life, have you ever seen such a city as this? A place of tall stone walls, of round stone towers. I don't mean here at these hills, but anywhere. In the north, by the great river, in the desert, of the west, anywhere."
"No," said High, "I have never seen such a place."
And I knew that there was no lost city north of the Great Pan or south of the Zambezi, for if there were, High would have come across it in 70 years of ceaseless wandering. It was probably some old bushman who wandered 270 miles east of here and saw the temple at Zimbabwe, I suggested to Sally that night as we sat around the fire and discussed the old bushman's story. He was so impressed that on his return he painted it.
"But then how do you explain your white king?"
"I don't know, Sal," I told her honestly. "Perhaps it is a white lady with a bouquet of flowers."
It seems that whenever I receive a serious disappointment, Sally's rejection of my proposal and the story of the moon city were both serious, my brain ceases to function for a period. I missed the clue completely, and the link-up was so obvious. I mean, for God's sake, I have a tested IQ of 156. I'm a goddamn genius. In the morning, the two bushmen went back to the families they'd left by the Pan. They took with them the treasures we lavished upon them: a hatchet, Sally's makeup mirror, two knives, and half a box of Romeo and Juliet cigars. They trotted away into the vastness of the Kalahari without a backward glance and left us the poorer for their going. The helicopter came the following week, bringing in a full load of supplies and the special equipment I had asked Lauren to send us. Sally and I carried the rubber dinghy up to the cavern and inflated it beside the pool, taking it in turns to blow until we felt dizzy. Sally launched it and paddled happily around the pool, while I assembled the rest of the equipment. There was a short glass-fiber fishing rod, a heavy one, 25 ounces, and in the case, which held a 12-stroke-0 Penn Senator fishing reel, was a note from Lauren. "What are you after for crying out loud? Sandfish or desert trout? L." I fitted the reel to rod, threaded the line through the runners, and attached the 5-pound lead weight to the end of it. Sally paddled us out into the center of the pool. I dropped the lead weight over the side, disengaged the clutch on the reel, and let the line start running out. As I had requested, the plaited Dacron line was marked at intervals of 50 feet. And as each marker of coloured cotton disappeared into the luminous green water, we counted aloud. 5, 6, 7. My God, Ben, it's bottomless. Oh, these limestone sinkholes can go down to tremendous depths. 11. 12. 13. I hope we got enough line. Sally eyed what remained on the spool dubiously.
We've got 800 yards here, I told her. It'll be more than enough.
16. 17.
Even I was impressed. I had guessed at a depth of around 400 feet, the same as the sleeping pool at Sinoia. But still the line unwound steadily from the big game fishing reel. At last I felt the weight bump on the bottom, and the line went slack. We looked at each other with awe. A little over 850 feet, I said.
Makes me feel scary, hanging over a hole in the earth as deep as that.
Well, I said with finality, I had plans to explore the bottom with a skewer, but that's out now. Whatever is down there will stay there forever. Nobody can dive that depth.
Sally looked down into the green depth, and the dappled, moving, reflected light illuminated her face weirdly. There were shadows in her eyes, and her expression was dazed. Suddenly, she shook herself violently, a shudder that went through her whole body, and she tore her eyes away from the green surface.
Oh, I felt funny then, a really creepy sensation, as though something walked over my grave.
I began to wind in the fishing line, and Sally lay back, flat on the floor of the dinghy, staring up at the rock roof high above. It was a laborious task to recover all that line, but I worked away steadily.
Ben, Sally spoke suddenly. Ben, look up there.
I stopped winding and looked up. We'd never looked up at the opening in the roof from this angle. The shape of the opening was different.
There. There, Ben, on the side, Sally pointed. That piece of rock sticking out. It's square. It's too regular to be natural, surely.
I studied it for a while.
Perhaps. I was dubious.
You know, we've never even tried to find where the cavern opens out onto the top of the hills, Ben.
Sally sat up excitedly.
Can't we do that? Let's go up and look at that piece of square stone. Can we, Ben?
Of course, I agreed readily.
Today, now. Can we go now?
Hell, Sal, it's after 2 o'clock already. We'll be out after dark.
Oh, come on. We can take torches with us.